Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Improvidential Grant of Certiorari Edition. Today our featured guest is Deputy District Attorney Ronald Eisenberg of the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, discussing Bell v. Kelly, heard in oral argument on Wednesday, November 12th, and dismissed as improvidently granted on Monday, November 17th. Thanks for tuning in. The Supreme Court granted certiorari in this case to consider the application of the deference rule in federal habeas review. The case arose from claims by Edward Bell of ineffective counsel during his sentencing following a 2001 conviction for murder. He was sentenced to death and, after having a habeas petition denied by the Virginia Supreme Court for failing to satisfy either prong of Strickland v. Washington, filed a habeas petition in federal district court alleging ineffective assistance of counsel. The district court considered new evidence not presented at trial and found that, while his counsel had been ineffective, the state court's determination that he had failed to satisfy the prejudice prong of Strickland was reasonable and thus entitled to deference. The district court thus did not grant relief, but did allow the case to be appealed. The Fourth Circuit on review considered only the prejudice prong and affirmed. Bell appealed to the Supreme Court, claiming that the deference rule should not apply to a claim based on evidence not heard by a state court, and the Supreme Court granted certiorari. However, after hearing oral argument in this case, the court dismissed the writ as improvidently granted, without comment. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Eisenberg.
There were big expectations for Bell v. Kelly, a habeas corpus case argued in the U.S. Supreme Court on November 12th. A decision on the issues presented would have a dramatic effect on the manner in which criminal defendants can attack their state court convictions by going to federal court. Or at least that's the way it looked before oral argument. But this is a case that went bust, leaving some important questions of law unresolved for now. As in most habeas cases, those questions are about the degree to which federal courts are empowered to redo decisions made by state courts on appeals by convicted criminals. Habeas corpus review is a creature of federal statute, not constitutional law. In this case, the specific statute at issue is Section 2254D, a provision that Congress added to the Habeas Corpus Act in 1995. This section is often called the deference rule. It prohibits a federal court from overturning a state court conviction based on a legal claim that the state courts have already considered, as long as the state court acted reasonably in denying the claim. In other words, the federal court cannot reverse the conviction even if it thinks that the state court's decision was wrong, as long as the state court was within the bounds of reasonableness. If there are reasonable grounds for disagreement, the federal court can no longer substitute its own view of the law for the state's. That's been easier said than done. The lower federal courts have demonstrated some difficulty getting used to the new rule. The Supreme Court has repeatedly reached out to reverse federal circuits for failing to accord the required deference to state court rulings. This case presented a variation on the basic deference question, one with potentially great impact. What happens when the criminal defendant loses his appeals in state court, but then comes to federal habeas court with new facts that he says he just found? Does the federal court still have to defer to the state court ruling based only on the original facts, or can it treat the new facts as creating a new claim, one which the state court never ruled on and therefore isn't subject to any deference? The case arose in October of 1999. Police Sergeant Ricky Timbrook was on patrol in Winchester, Virginia, when he spotted the defendant, Edward Bell, a drug dealer from Jamaica. This was not their first encounter. Sergeant Timbrook had arrested Bell before, leading to deportation proceedings against the defendant. Bell declared that someone ought to shoot the officer in the head. On this occasion, at first Bell fled on seeing the officer, but then he turned and shot Sergeant Timbrook in the face. Bell was eventually captured, convicted, and sentenced to death. On appeal in state court, the defendant claimed that his trial lawyers provided ineffective assistance of counsel. Allegedly, they did not present enough sympathetic mitigation evidence at the sentencing hearing to convince the jury to impose a life sentence rather than the death penalty. The Virginia Supreme Court reviewed the extra mitigation evidence put forth by the defendant's new lawyers, but the court concluded that the evidence was not persuasive and that the defendant's original lawyers were not ineffective. So the defendant filed a habeas corpus petition in federal court. There, his lawyers persuaded the federal judge to grant them an evidentiary hearing, where they presented extra mitigation evidence to, quote, supplement and clarify the material they had placed before the state court. After hearing the evidence, the federal judge concluded, like the Virginia Supreme Court, that it wouldn't have changed the sentence. The defendant appealed again to the Federal Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. That court held that the Virginia Supreme Court ruling was entitled to deference under Section 2254D of the federal habeas statute, and that the state court ruling was not unreasonable. At that point, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take the case for review to determine whether deference applies in these circumstances. In his briefs, the criminal defendant argued for a very low threshold for the presentation of new evidence in federal court. He said that whenever a defendant offers evidence that would affect the court's impression or analysis of the case, then his claim becomes, in essence, a different claim than the one he argued in the state court. Since it's a different claim, it's not the one the state court ruled on, and therefore the federal habeas court no longer has to give deference to the state court ruling under Section 2254D. The defendant argued that this view is supported by the next subsection of the habeas statute, 2254E. Subsection E spells out the circumstances in which a federal habeas judge is authorized to convene an evidentiary hearing. Basically, a hearing is allowed if it's not the defendant's fault he didn't get one in state court. If that standard is met, contends the defendant, then subsection D, the deference rule, shouldn't stand in his way. There would be no point in holding a hearing under subsection E if the judge was prohibited from considering any new evidence by virtue of subsection D. E trumps D. In the defendant's view, new evidence frees the federal court to ignore what the state court already did. In the state's view, on the other hand, this approach would make for an all-too-easy path around the deference requirement. The problem is particularly acute in death penalty cases, says the state, because under the Supreme Court's Lockett v. Ohio case, defendants are allowed to offer just about anything under the sun as mitigation evidence at the sentencing hearing. It's hard to imagine a lawyer who couldn't come up with some new thing about the defendant's life at the federal habeas stage and thereby circumvent the state court's decision. The state argues that subsection E of the habeas statute, which addresses evidentiary hearings, doesn't come into play here. Instead, it's designed for a different kind of case, where, for example, the defendant missed his deadline in state court, and so the state court didn't ever decide the merits of his claim. In that sort of case, the deference provision of subsection D wouldn't apply anyway, because there was no state ruling to defer to. Subsection E is intended to govern those situations where there was never an issue of deference. E doesn't supplant D, it just supplements it. Of course, the Supreme Court wasn't obligated to choose a view at either end of the spectrum. Oral argument would have been expected to explore hypotheticals somewhere in between. What about, for example, a case where the defendant in state court said his lawyer was ineffective for not calling an alibi witness, but now, in federal court, he says there was also a character witness who should have been presented? Is that a separate, new claim to which deference doesn't apply? What if the defendant previously objected because the prosecutor, in his closing argument, mentioned the defendant invoked his Miranda rights when he was arrested, but now, in federal court, there's an additional allegation that the prosecutor separately referred to the defendant's failure to take the stand at trial? Are those the same claim because they both implicate the defendant's Fifth Amendment right to silence? There were many such questions for the justices to discuss, but that's not how things turned out. Right at the start, Justice Alito asked the defendant's counsel about the statement of the question presented on page 1 of his brief, which asserted that the state court had refused to consider important evidence. Counsel now conceded that, in fact, there was no such evidence that the state courts had refused to consider, nor was there any contention that the prosecution had withheld any evidence. The only reason the defense offered for presenting new evidence for the first time in federal court that it hadn't offered in state court was because the lawyers hadn't had enough time to get to it all earlier. Several justices, including Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Souter, and Stevens, seemed to think that this presented a different and less compelling case than the one they had hoped to review. When the court asked the state's lawyer, Catherine Burnett, how they should resolve the question that was actually before them, she said, "Don't. Dismiss the petition for certiorari as improvidently granted." By the end of that week, just 2 days after oral argument, that's exactly what the court decided to do. That result was a clear victory for the state in this particular prosecution, but it left significant questions unresolved. For one thing, the need to define a claim under the deference rule exists not just in relation to factual distinctions, but to legal ones as well. What if, for example, the state court decides that an alleged constitutional violation was harmless, but doesn't bother to determine whether there was really error to begin with? Are the harm and error issues all one claim, or two? How do you apply deference? Another problem arises because of the tension between deference and the exhaustion requirement. Under that requirement, defendants have to raise all their claims in state court first. If new evidence in federal court makes for a new claim, then you've gotten around deference, but not exhaustion. As the Bell v. Kelly case seems to suggest, though, in practice criminal defendants would rather face the exhaustion bar than the deference bar. It's proven easier to overcome. Finally, there's the issue of successive petitions. That's where a defendant who's already had one habeas petition in federal court tries to file a second. Under the habeas statute, he can't, at least if the claim in the second petition is the same as the claim in the first petition. As noted in the amicus brief filed by Kent Scheidegger of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, the rule ought to be the same for deference as it is for successive petitions. But will there be as much protection for prior state court rulings under the deference rule as there is for prior federal court rulings under the successive petition rule? Over the past century and a half, the power of federal judges to review state criminal convictions has waxed and waned as Congress and the courts have amended and interpreted the habeas corpus statute. Technical as they appear at first glance, the questions raised by the Bell v. Kelly case will, when finally decided, have much to say about where the balance will be drawn in our day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.